Thank you very much for the invitation. I'm very excited to tell you about some of this work in the area of effective algebraic homotopical constructions. And the motivation actually comes from something that Anton asked when I was a grad student at Stony Brook, who was spending some time at the Simon Center. It's mostly going to be a mathematical talk, but I do want to emphasize that the original question was motivated by some puzzles in topological phases. So, but before I start with the math, let me pause here for a moment. Okay, so a bit of a motivation and an outline. And again, I expect that after this visit at the Perimeter Institute, I understand more about the original motivation. But currently, this is how I see it. We're interested in the classification of symmetry protected topological faces. And one could have definitions of these field theories using a triangulation of space-time and using co-chains as fields. So the cellular structure that is given by the triangulation, then we take linear combinations of those cells as the basis. And the passage from bosonic to fermionic phases is where we bring this C to symmetry, which expresses itself as having co-chains with coefficients in the field with two elements. And since we are going to be considering cohomological invariants, it is very natural to encounter the Steenrod squares, which are primary operations on cohomology with mod 2 coefficients. So it's a very natural set of operations. And since we are moving into considering this fermionic systems, then it is not a surprise that we will encounter this cohomological invariant. And since we're thinking about triangulated spacetimes and co-chains as fields, we would like to represent this cohomological structure at the co-chain level. And this was the original definition of this invariance given by Steenrod in the late 40s. He presented co-chain level constructions through the so-called Kappa-I products. Then it is not surprising that we will encounter relations that are satisfied by these Steenrod squares. The first one's called the Cartan relation that tells us the relationship that exists between them and the product structure in cohomology, the cup product, and the Adem relation that tells us how these Steenrod squares behave with respect to iteration. And out of these relations, we encounter secondary operations. And then the question would be, can we represent these relations at the co-chain level? Again, the viewpoint is to have everything lifted the co-chain level, this cohomological structure, and therefore can we find representatives that enforce those relations as co-boundaries. So what am I going to spend today's talk discussing is the Kappa-I products. I would like to present other ways of thinking about them. I would like to characterize them axiomatically and then describe a co-chain level proof of the Cartan relation that is effective. So we're going to construct co-chains related to this relation. And if we have time, I might also say a couple of words of how to generalize those ideas to also prove the Adem relation from this effective co-chain level viewpoint. So I would like to make a note here that I think is worth emphasizing in this context is I take it almost as a synonym when we discuss co-chain level constructions. Those can be thought of as done locally, one simplex at a time. The cohomological invariants are global in nature. The kind of constructions that we're going to be attempting to do today are actually done simplex by simplex. Okay. Any comments or questions about this outline? Let me move on now into some motivation. So the product in cohomology, I'm just going to review some very basic notions. Let's consider the diagonal map of spaces. This is the most natural map after the identity map. And if we apply a cohomology functor, we're going to get a map in the other direction. And if we are in a situation in which the Kunneff theorem applies, then we can obtain through this diagonal a product in cohomology. So this would be a cut product in that situation. But the question now is, how do we define this structure locally when we're in the presence of a triangulation of the space X? How do we lift it to the cochain level? And this was done in the 30s. Usually the names associated with this are Alexander and Whitney, but they also had some help, let's say, from Kolmogorov and Chek. And the approach was to have a chain approximation to the diagonal of the standard simplices that is defined in a coherent manner, and then dualize this structure to get a product at the level of cochains. So for example, if dimension is 1, yes, this n is the same as that dimension, then what we're after is a linear map that will take, say, the degree 1 basis element here to an approximation to the diagonal, which diagonal will be here, but we're in the algebraic context, so there's no basis element like that, so we have to approximate, say, making that choice. And this is the usual formula that the Alexander-Whitney diagonal or co-product defines. So we're familiar with that. Now, unlike the diagonal of spaces that satisfies some nice symmetries, we can permute the factors and leave its image invariant. As we saw before, we had to choose a way of approximating it. But if we transpose factors, we'll get something different. So there's no preservation of that C-mod 2 symmetry that the usual diagonal has. And in order to reconstitute this symmetry, we'll do it through a derived process. So what Steenrod did was to correct this broken symmetry by introducing higher order diagonals that correct the broken symmetry up to coherent homotopies. So these are the so-called kappa-i co-products that Steenrod defined via explicit formulae. Again, these are defined, and I want to emphasize this, locally, one simplex at a time. And the main homological relation that this higher diagonals have to satisfy is that the ith one is a homotopy or is a co-boundary for the symmetry of the previous one. So the kappa-i products are simply defined in terms of linear duals for this higher diagonals. So the formula is here. The kappa-i coproducts between two cochains just going to be to apply both of those cochains to the output of the ith Steenrod diagonal. And with this structure, the kappa-i coproducts, we can represent at the cochain level the product in cohomology through this usual formula. And we can also represent the Steenrod squares in terms of this formula down here. Notice that the kappa-i coproduct that we use depends on both the k for the Steenrod square that we're considering, but also on the dimension of the class to which we're computing this square. OK, so what's the take-home message? The kappa-i coproducts are the correct lift of the Steenrod squares to the cochain level. Now, I would like to be more explicit now and give formulae that describe these kappa-i coproducts. In fact, these are new. I will need a little bit of notation to describe them. The first one, the first piece of notation that I'm going to use is the usual face maps that are defined simply by removing the vertex in the indicated position. Now, I'm going to call P up n lower q should be just a collection of subsets of the integers between 0 and n. What subsets? Those that have cardinality q. Very straightforward object. And if I give myself one of these objects, let's go ahead and use the linear order on the integers to order the elements in this subset. I'm going to write d sub the subset to be the natural composition of the phase maps associated to its elements. And finally, I'm going to split this subset u in a partition that has two elements. So I'm going to split it into a couple of disjoint subsets whose union is the original u. And for epsilon either 0 or 1, the partitioning element, the partitioning subset u sub epsilon is going to contain all the elements in u whose position plus its value is either 0 or 1 modulo 2. So there's some kind of index here, the value plus the position in u, and all of those that are odd with respect to this index go to one side, and those that are even with respect to that index go to the other side. And with this notation, let me introduce some very explicit formulas that describe a family of higher diagonals that satisfy that homological relation that I showed before. For a basis element x that, say, is of dimension m, the action of the delta I, or the ith coproduct, is going to be a sum over all the subsets of integers between 0 and n of the cardinality, the difference between m and I, where we apply on the left one side of the partition, one subset of the partition, and on the other side we apply the other one. I really like this formula. If you know how it was originally defined, you will see some simplifications that come from this. But let's see it in action. For example, let's consider that we're going to compute using this formula the first diagonal, actually the original Alexander and Whitney diagonal, on a very simple element of dimension 2 in this case. So according to the formula, we're going to have to take subsets of cardinality 2 minus 0, 2, between integers between 0 and 2. So there are three of those, and the partitioning described here splits them in this way. And if we make it act, well, we recover the usual front phase, back phase formula that defines the Alexander-Whitney coproduct. Any comments? All right. So I'm saying that these new formulas are not those that were introduced by Steenrod. And there are other authors that have also introduced some formulae defining these higher diagonals. And when I say this higher diagonals, I should say finding higher diagonals that satisfy the homological relation. And a question that, yes.
Just to be sure, so your formula is like homotopic to the original one, or it's literally the same?
Well, we don't know yet. So the only thing that I'm claiming is that this formula satisfies the homological relation, right? And therefore, we could use it to define the product, and we can use it to define the Steenrod squares. Now, Steenrod also introduced formulae at the cochain level that satisfy the homological relations. So at the level of cohomology, they give the same structure because it's easy to see that they are homotopic to one another. But the question that remains is, do they actually agree in a stronger sense and not just up to homotopy? And I was also mentioning that these formulas are different in principle. Actually, the formulas are different from Steenrod's and also formulas that have been introduced by other authors. So there was a bunch of formulae out there. But every time that we look at them, they were producing the same things at lower level. So it turns out, as the title of the slide says, all of those agree. In fact, is kind of cattle and numbers, right? So you can give a bunch of different definitions. They all end up giving rise to the same mathematical objects, but presented in different ways. So we can characterize axiomatically up to isomorphism, a very strong condition, this higher diagonals. I would like to quickly go over the type of conditions that completely determine them up to isomorphism. So the first one is that they're not degenerate. So we want to rule out the case of all the maps being zero. So this is done by saying that it acts non-trivially on vertices. The next one is that it is irreducible. This is kind of saying that if you're going to act on a simplex X, then you have to involve all the simplices that appear in X. Otherwise, you can just go to a lower dimensional simplex, and that is not something that we want. And finally, we're going to demand that these formulas have the largest amount of possible freedom with respect to the transposition. So we say it is free if whenever X cup I is the same as I cup X, then this is zero, unless one dimension, there's one exclusion. So this would be the strongest version of being free. The only exclusion happens when they're both equal to I, and they have I as their, sorry, I said it wrong. When they both have dimension equal to I. This is what happens at the top. For example, this is non-zero, right? So if we don't exclude this case, then we cannot have something like this. So always at the top, you are allowed to not have freedom, but everywhere else you are enforcing it. And once we have these conditions, we can prove that any two formulas, any two collection of maps, will be equal up to a transposition in every level. So this is interesting to me because it's pointing out to the fact that this construction is kind of fundamental, universal, and I think nowadays I like to explain this by connecting it to convex geometry. So there's only one orthonormal basis or classes of orthonormal basis for the standard simplices. And out of that observation is that one can prove this type of statements. Although originally I proved it algebraically. Anyway, so Kappa-I products are not just choose whatever homotopical ones that you want to. They are in fact preferred collections. Okay, so this comes now to the Cartan relation. But before changing gears, maybe questions or comments? All right. So the Cartan relation at the level of cohomology gives us this expression, which is relating the square applied to the product to a product of squares applied to each of the factors. Now let me write it this way. By the way, I'm only going to be talking with Mod 2 coefficients throughout the talk. I should have emphasized that earlier. So this is equivalent to the earlier one. And if we lift this to the cochain level, remember that both the product and the Steenrod squares were defined in terms of the kappa I products. So this expression is related to this expression over here. And this expression is related to this expression over here. Is that clear? Okay, right. And what we're after is a cochain that depends naturally on alpha and beta, whose co-boundary is equal to the expression on the right. So when we descend to cohomology, the right becomes this side. And well, this is a very explicit co-boundary that will enforce the relation. So this is what I will call a Cartan co-boundary. And the question is, well, how do we construct it? And I'm going to need a couple of tools to do this. The first one is the well-known Eilimer Zilberg, Alexander Whitney contraction. And this starts with the observation that for simplicial sets, the chains on the product is not isomorphic to the tensor product of the chains. But they're explicit, and again, I want to emphasize the locally defined nature of these maps, that relate them. So if we want to go from the chains on the product to the product on the chains, we have this explicitly and locally defined map AW that takes us there, and we have the EZ map going in the other direction. And the term contraction here refers to the fact that if we do one composition, we get the identity. This is like the formation retraction type of idea in the algebraic context. And if we do the composition in the other way, we don't get the identity. Oh, there's a typo here. This should be equal to the identity plus this term. Okay. So one is the identity strictly, and the other one is the identity up to homotopy. And in fact, the homotopy, I'm giving it a name because it has also been presented through locally defined expressions. So it's another thing that we have concrete formulae defining them. Okay, so this map is, we can think of it as the deformation in the deformation retraction. Okay, so these guys are going to play a role. And remember, this comes from the fact that this is not a monoidal factor, functor. It is lax and bilax. And these are the structures that are enforcing that. Okay, so another tool that we're going to need is some group homology notions. And let's consider the universal bundle of some group. Over here we have classifying space, the universal bundle, and the action of G. And by definition, the group homology of G is the usual homology of the classifying space. Now, we're going to use an explicit model. This whole talk is about explicit things. So we're going to use a very explicit model for the universal bundle, EG, that is constructed using the following sets. At level n in the simplicial set, we're just going to take tuples of n plus 1 elements in the group. And the phase and the degeneracy maps are given by the leading elements in the tuple or repeating them. Now let me define an element that is going to appear a lot. We're going to mostly be centered on symmetric groups, even more specifically in the symmetric group on two letters and the symmetric group on four letters. So those are the two examples that we're going to use this construction on. And the element xi is just going to be this non-degenerate element that lives in dimension I of the universal bundle of S2. And notice that there are only two non-degenerate elements at this level. And the other one is obtained by applying the action of the transposition on the left to each element. Another thing to mention, yes, what is the action of the group G here is given by left multiplication of every element in the tuple. Now, let's use this terminology to reinterpret what the Steenberg construction was doing. So we have now a map from this particular model sending the xi element and a pair of cochains to the kappa I product here. And here, this is a tensor product over S2. So it's a balanced tensor product. If we apply the transposition to the left, that's equivalent to applying the permutation on the right. So this is the structure that we had. And if we apply this to elements of the form alpha tensor alpha, those are invariant with respect to the transposition. So this descends to a map associated to the classifying space. And this is the kind of expression that we saw defining the Steenberg squares. So what I want to emphasize out of this description is that the steamroll squares are controlled by the cohomology with mod 2 coefficients of the group S2. Now, here's a very interesting algebraic structure that the symmetric groups carry. We'll say that they define an operand. In general, if you give an element in the symmetric group with R elements, then you get symmetric groups on other symmetric groups. You get a symmetric group on the sum of those. Right? And I'm only going to be looking at this special case. So let me spend a little bit more time explaining it here, but it's the same idea over there. So if we have S2, an element there, and then I have two elements here, so we want to have something acting on four elements. So we're going to act with the first transposition on the first two, the second transposition on the right on the other two, and the third transposition that is on the leftmost part is going to permute those two pairs. So that's the same structure that we have over there, and therefore this map factors through the balanced product. So here's an example. I'm using the notation for S4 here. Now, the construction that we presented before, the E construction for the universal bundle, is functorial. So we obtain out of this compositions at the level of simplicial sets. And we can go even further and get this type of compositions at the level of chain complexes. So this would be what we get just by applying the a functor of chains. I'm using this notation to simplify what I'm writing. So this is the chains on EOS SR. I'm only writing this. So this is what we get simply applying the functor of chains. But we can use now the EZ map to precompose and define something that goes from this triple to E4. All right, so if you encounter this kind of structures before, this is part of the so-called Barrett-Eccles operand. And that Barrett-Eccles operand was presented and introduced by Berger and Fraisse in 2004, and they construct explicit SR equivariant quasi-isomorphisms that go from this ER to the complex of natural linear maps from R copies of the cochains into the cochains. And the very important thing here is that this map that they constructed is compatible with respect to compositions that I described before, and the obvious compositions that we have here in the space of linear maps. Furthermore, if we specialize it at R equals 2, those prefer generators that we discussed before, it mapped to the Kappa-I products. The same Kappa-I products that we axiomatized earlier on. Here's a reference. I'm not going to spend time describing Berger and Fraisse's construction, but it's very combinatorial and something that a computer can understand. So I'm also going to warn you about some notational abuse that I'm going to engage in. And I'm going to suppress the notation of this map. Sometimes I'm going to be referring to elements here. Sometimes I'm going to be referring to their corresponding maps, natural maps. So this is the warning that I want to raise. OK. No comments, no questions? OK, so let me introduce the main maps that we're going to use to do this construction of Cartan co-boundaries. The maps are called F and G. And I'm going to present them as a composition of two maps. But we should think of them as maps going from E2 to E4. The first one is given, both of them use the composition that we described before. The first one just has x0, x0 in the first two factors, and is sending the element that we fit it in to be the one that we're composing over. And this one, you're composing over just the base one, x0, and you have to apply the Alexander Whitney to the other one. So you split it into two parts, and then you compose them. Natural maps, they're chain maps. And here's the reason why we want to consider them. If we evaluate 2, 3 is the action of the transposition in S4, the image of f of xi. So this is an element, xi is an element in E2, we apply f in that in E4. E4 has an action of S4 in it, so I'm acting by the transposition 2, 3 on that element. And we add G, so this is a new map. And now using the Berger-Fress map, we can think of this as something that acts on cochains. So I'm gonna make it act on this cochain. And what we get is this expression. So here we're using the fact that the Berger-Fress map preserves compositions. So we recover the right-hand side of the lifted Cartan relation. Okay. So in order to construct this Cartan co-boundary, the strategy that we're gonna follow is to construct a homotopy between these two maps. Okay. So what's gonna be the upshot? If we have a homotopy between F acted by 2, 3 and G, and it satisfies the following form of equivariance. So if you have 1, 2 before, you can pull it out on the other side by acting with this transposition. Then we can define a Cartan co-boundary by taking the image of xi and applying it to this guy. And the term Cartan co-boundary, I referred to it before, is just saying that the co-boundary of this co-chain is equal to this lifted Cartan relation. I want to emphasize a point that Yuan Chen, that has been working on applying this to the physics side, has emphasized to me that this formula only works for co-cycles. And yes, that is true. And it seems like the current frontier is to try to get this to work for more general co-chains. Okay, so now we have transformed the original question, the one about finding Cartan co-boundaries, to a question about constructing this homotopy H. And we're gonna use two steps in this. So the first will depend on understanding a pair of conjugate group homomorphisms. In order to define them, let me look at the possible inclusions from S2 into the product of that group with itself. Well, there are three natural ones, right? So we can include it into the first factor, we can include it into the second factor, or we can include it diagonally. And the homomorphisms, the two homomorphisms that we're gonna be considering are suggestively denoted F and G as well. But this is at the level of groups. And they're defined similarly as before in using the composition on the operator of groups here. So here is explicitly, we just obviously map the identity to the identity. The non-trivial element goes either to 1, 3, 2, 4, or to 1, 2, 3, 4. And the observation here is that these maps are conjugate of each other. This is an important observation. Okay, so the first thing that I want to do is to relate the big maps to the little maps. So we start by reminding ourselves again that this construction of the universal bundle is functorial, this simplicial construction. So we're going to get a induced simplicial map, EF, and then we can apply the functor of chains. And turns out that for the Fs, both of these maps agree on the nose. Okay, that's a direct computation. The next thing that I want us to look at is G. Let's recall that G is defined like this. And notice a bit of a typo here, that tilde shouldn't be here. But anyway, this was the definition. And remember that the composition at the level of the linear operat was defined in terms of the composition at the level of the simplicial operats, applying the chains to it. But before that, we had to apply the Ellenberg-Zilber map. So this is what is happening to go from this line to this one. Now we are remembering that this composition was the non-trivial composition, but we have a homotopy that will do the trick there. So we have the identity plus this homotopy over here. And the observation is that this guy is precisely the one induced by little f. So if we call H2 the map defined by this Xi map, the one that appears in the EZAW contraction, now the difference between the big G and the one induced from the little g is zero up to an explicit homotopy given by H2. Okay, and I do want to emphasize this, it's done locally, one simplicity at a time, and it's very explicit, and the definition of explicit I'm using is that a computer could do this. Okay, so this H2 is going to be part of the H that we're after. And I should say, I'm not going to verify this, but that this H2 satisfies the equivariance that we need for the H to work in the previous theorem. Okay, so that's one part of the construction. The other one is motivated by a slogan, and I think it's a very useful and important slogan. Conjugate maps induce homotopic maps on classifying spaces. So if there's one thing that you could take from this talk and that might help you in other contexts, is this slogan. So let's bring some meat into this in the particular context in which we're considering it. Let's recall that little f and little g are conjugate maps. And we're going to define H1, which is again going to be a map from the linear E2 and the linear E4, and it's defined very explicitly in these terms. It's going to be a sum. What we first apply pure G's, and then intermediate step, we apply a mixture of two, three F's and G's, and at the end, we just apply pure two, three F's. So we're kind of interpolating between them. And using a telescopic sum argument, we can show that this H2 map interpolates between, interpolates between EG, the map associated to little g, and the map associated to 2, 3, little f. And so this is, since g and f are conjugate, we get this explicit homotopy between.
Could this be a 1?
Say it again?
In H1?
This is supposed to be an H1. Thank you. Yeah, and it's weird that I presented H2 before. It's just because in the paper is that way. So if you look at the paper, I don't want you to get confused. But the presentation that I chose reversed the order. Okay, so we have this two homotopies, H1, and the one that we defined before, H2. And before I can conclude anything, I should make a claim that this other homotopy, H1, not H2 here, satisfies the same equivariance property that we're demanding from H. And let me just repeat the upshot. If we now define H to be the sum of these two homotopies, again, applying the Berger-Fresse, we can think of them as acting on co-chains. And if we act on this co-chain, we get a Cartan co-boundary. And what was the meaning of that? It just means a co-chain whose co-boundary is equal to the lift of the Cartan relation. And again, here's this word cocycle I want to get rid of. Not in this talk, though, for future things. I'm just repeating the upshot. If we descend to cohomology, we recover the Cartan relation. This is pretty much a good point to say to answer questions if you guys have any. And did you give my computer internet? 1 second. I just hope for the best. So let's do some examples, because the goal here, by the way, I should say that Kapustin was asking for this thing. So that was the motivation, and that explains his name in the title. Okay, so examples. My computer is connected now. So let's take elements in the natural numbers. Let's define n of I, another integer, which would be the smallest integer such that the action of this Cartan co-boundary on the standard simplex associated to it is not identically zero. So those are boring. Let's look, we're gonna present examples that are the first non-trivial for every I. So the value obtained here is defined to be that of evaluating this cochain on the following expressions. To do it. No kernel. It's not good. But anyway, this is a Jupyter notebook that can be run online. And so these are the answers to the question presented before. How do we compute those elements? We evaluate alpha, alpha, beta, beta on the following outputs. So here we're going to have, move the mouse here. Stay in the page. Yeah. So.
What are you doing?
Can I do it again? Maybe not. Okay. Sorry, this I was expecting it to go a little smoothly. But anyway, so we apply alpha and alpha to this side, beta and beta on that side, and we get the first non-trivial output. For the next one, when we're looking at the first Cartan relation,
can you use the hockey stick if you feel like it?
I don't think it's this. Oh, you think it is?
I think it's a pointer.
Oh, I think it's a pointer. Yes, and I get an excuse to use this. So if we now look at I equals to 1, this is the first Cartan relation, I 1. We're going to get the element by applying alpha and alpha, beta and beta, alpha, alpha, beta and beta. And as you can see, this continues. And it took a long time to just show up that, hey, this can be done by a computer. Right? And if you want to play with it, I should mention that it's supposed to be simple. Just go to my web page, and here there's effective construction like a Kartankov boundaries, and it runs online, so you don't have to install anything. Anyway, okay, so maybe this is all I wanted to say with respect to the Cartan relation. And in the abstract, I said time permitting, I will talk about the ADEM relation. I see that I have some time, but I didn't have time to prepare that. So, this is where I'm going to stop. Thank you.
Questions for the speaker?
Oh yeah. Can I get rid of this and talk on the?
Yeah, there should be a control there to raise the screen. Is it?
No. Yeah. So the question about other primes is very puzzling. I'm not sure how it connects with physics though. I know that the Montreux symmetry is the one bringing Steenrod squares, but there's a natural question about how to, first of all, generalize the Kappi products to Kapp PI products that lift to the co-chain level the Steenrod operations that are defined with those coefficients. The first thing to say is that in the literature, we did not have such a generalization because topology kind of moved into a less constructive methods, and one can use group homology, as we kind of saw here, to define them. But if one tries, you can actually find this generalization of the Kappi products to Kapp PI products, and they are also amenable to be implemented. So that's another thing, that it's available in those lists of software that I have there, where you can find implementations for those constructions. Now, you'll ask, oh, how about proving also the ADEM and Cartan relations for those operations? They satisfy the same type of relations at the cohomology level, and now we know how to lift them to the co-chain level, but it hasn't been done yet how to prove the Cartan and the ADEM relation effectively at the co-chain level. Although the Cartan relation seems to be a natural generalization, which is work in progress. The ADEM relation, there's a piece of the puzzle that is missing. There's something that Greg Bramfield and John Morgan, I think they are trying to do, but it's too hard for me. I don't wanna try. The Cartan relation, yes, is something more doable. And maybe I will just tell you what is the key idea. No luck? Okay, no luck. Is it visible over here? So let me summarize a bit what we did and how it is generalized to prove the ADEM relation. So essentially we had this, actually even more fundamentally, we had the S2 mapping to S2 cross S2 cross S2. This was balanced over S2. And we have this two inclusions. And then using the composition, we landed in S4. And we can include one way, and that will give us the F, little f, and we include the other way that gives us the other G. Those two maps are homotopic, and then we use the slogan, conjugate maps induce homotopic maps at the level of classifying spaces. So what is the analog for the ADEM relation? We actually consider now a map from S2 cross S2 in here. That does what we did before, essentially. You copy this element here, and you double this element. And there's a symmetry here given by transposition. So if you actually compose before with S2, say that we always include in the first factor, and then we apply the symmetry, that will recover the previously defined little f and little g. In the case of the Adem relation, you just have to work at this level. And again, you have a little f, little g, and you have to do these two maps. That would be one of the homotopies, which is like the H2 that was appearing in the talk. And there's also another piece of the puzzle here that had to do with what are the corresponding big F and big G, right? So this is the analog of the little f and the little g. And in the other case, we have to use the following composition, E2 tensor E2 goes to E2 where first you apply the usual delta zero, since this is are the chains on a simplicial set. We know how to apply the Alexander-Whitney diagonal to get two copies. We leave the other one invariant, I should say unchanged. And now this is a simplicial set. So we know how to make the steam rod thing act. So we can now leave the first part invariant and apply the, let's say, the operat structure here to land in E2 tensor E2. So this lands on, maybe I want to go down to E2 All right, so I don't know if I've been clear about what this map is. For any simplicial set, we have these maps, E2 tensor chains on X, going to the chains on X, tensor chains of X. So this is part of what Bergeron Fraisse did. So this guy is a simplicial set itself, so we can apply it to it. And this is the meaning of this other map. And finally, we have this composition that landed in E4. So then if we look at the images of the XP and XQ, they are going to land in the left-hand side of the Adem relation. And if we look at the transposition, it will land on the other side of the Adem relation, up to suspension, but let's not talk about that. So this is now finding a homotopy between those two maps. It's kind of finding a homotopy between the Fs and the corresponding little ones. And at the level of the little ones, we have also an explicitly constructed homotopy realizing this log. Okay, that's how the Adem relation goes. Okay.
More questions? Well, if there are no more questions, we should thank the speaker again.
Thank you.